Okay, this is talking with John Evans on 7 August 1978 at Helsinki and IRSI meeting. And could you tell me, first of all, what your educational background was and then how you first came in contact with radar or radio astronomy?
Yeah, well, in 1954 I went to the University of Manchester, no, 1951 it would be, went to the University of Manchester. Entered the physics department, working for what in the English call an honours degree in physics. And that was awarded to me in 1954, 3 years later. And that time in Britain, there were a number of scholarships available for people to stay on, go for PhDs. Mm-hmm. And it was virtually unknown for people to do this without receiving one of these scholarships.
Right. So,
you really have to have a fair amount of independent means to do that. And our particular department, this department at the University of Manchester, had some 8 of these, and the graduating class was about 80. So they interviewed the top 10 in the class, gave out 8. And well, remember this, because I wasn't near the top of the top 10, so I was one of the doubtful ones, mm-hmm. whether I'd get one or not. I was quite anxious to. The interviewing committee consisted of all the professors in the department, which were about 4 or 5. There was Lovell, who was the head of radio astronomy. Mm-hmm. There was Capel, who was head of astronomy. And there were others, who was the head of professor of theoretical physics. And another head of cosmic ray physics group, and so on. And they asked me what I'd like to do, and I said, well, I wanted to go to Jodrell Bank and do radar, or radio astronomy. And that was fine. I explained my reasons that I'd specialised in doing electronics in my last year, and our particular system we're able to specialise in your 3rd year.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd really spent my 3rd year in the electrical engineering department. And well, they said, what's your second choice? And I said, well, I didn't have a second choice. I couldn't go to Jodrell Bank, I didn't want to go. And I wasn't sure this is a wise strategy
right.
or not.
Right.
Anyway, it turned out to be a wise one. Lovell was looking for somebody who claimed to know something about electronics, because this moon radar had just been built. Murray and Hargreaves had both left, and so there's this huge room full of equipment. So
I see.
He thought it would never run again. Nobody would ever get it to work again.
Well, could you tell me just what you do know, since I've talked to neither of them, about what they did?
Yeah. Murray was an older guy. I think he'd been in the Navy. Anyway, he'd done his national service, which in those days meant 2 years service. And his was the first successful attempt to get moon echoes. There'd been prior attempts by Bramley and others at Jodrell, but without success. And the real lack was of an adequate sized antenna. Murray built an antenna which only allowed you to look at the moon for an hour. It was a fixed due south pointing phased array, really. By adjusting the phasing of it, you could set the elevation,
mm-hmm.
but you could only see the moon at transit, meridian transit. And this gave him the sensitivity to detect moon echoes fairly reliably.
Because he didn't have to physically move the whole antenna, you mean?
Yeah, it was small enough. He could build a big enough array. It was close to the ground. It was actually an Etalon rating. Anyway, this...
What was Murray's first name?
We all called him Sandy. His initials were WAS. And what they stand for, I don't know. But his nickname was Sandy. We called him Sandy Murray. And one amusing story. Sandy was pretty uptight. Been struggling long to get this moon echoes, and this building this antenna was sort of the big last throw, you understand. And he really did a nice job, but he was building all of the antenna himself with the help of technicians, and it was all open wire transmission lines,
mm-hmm.
of drawn copper wire, and it was a complicated phasing network of sliding sort of trombone systems to adjust the phase.
What sort of frequency was this?
This was 120 megacycles. And unfortunately, where Sandy was building the antenna was where a path had cut from one of the labs across to another lab on the Jodrell Bank. And on several nights, when Sandy came back the next morning, he found that some of his wires were broken. And so he concluded that people were trying to use this path despite the fact he was building his antenna there. And he got very upset. And at one lunchtime, the assembled room sort of stood up and said, "The next bugger that walks through my antenna, I'll kill him." It was a deathly silence. And then Tom Kaiser, who was at Dropper Bank in those days, quietly took Sandy aside and said maybe Jack Frost was doing it. And that indeed was the explanation. He'd been stretching the wire so tight that when it cooled off at night, they snap.
Now, you say that there had been efforts before to detect the moon, but were these with antennas especially built for that, or were they just taking the meteor radar and taking a quick look at the moon?
I think they took the 30-foot dish.
Oh, the one that Rod Davies
used
for H1?
Used sort of transmission lines running out from the moon hub to it. That was totally inadequate. Anyway.
McMurray, you say, did get a degree finally.
Yes, he got his degree finally. He actually had a nervous breakdown of the whole thing.
And what about this other fellow, Hargreaves?
Hargreaves was essentially only working for a master's degree. Had this funny system in Manchester that sort of admitted you and they sort of evaluated you. And at least that was the way Lovell ran it. Principally, you were supposed to write a master's thesis and then you were allowed to go on for the PhD. And that took 2 years. No, that was done at the end of the first year, I'm sorry. Those people Lovell felt were going to make it anyway, he told them not to write the master's degree thesis, and he wrote a letter to the head of the department saying that he was excusing this guy and he was going on directly for his PhD. That's what happened to me. But in Hargreaves' case, Lovell must have either said, he either was known at the outset he was only going for a master's degree, or Lovell was sort of told him that he didn't think he was suitable for a PhD and that he should have to write a master's degree.
So he was assisting Murray more.
So he was essentially assisting Murray.
Well, so you came on the scene, and now it's 1956 before there are any publications, of course, but you were a fresh graduate student in 54, so
my thesis supervisor was Ian Brown, who'd come from Oxford, had a little bit of radar experience, and he and I were told by Lovell essentially to do something with the moon radar.
So Brown was a member of the staff?
Yes, Brown was a member of the staff, so it was a lecturer. And what Ian thought we should do was measure the number of electrons in the ionosphere, because Murray had correctly identified the Faraday rotation effect as giving one of the causes of fading. At that time, it was known that moon echoes fade, but the full spectrum of causes was not known, and Murray identified a slow fading mechanism as being caused by the planar rotation being rotated in the ionosphere. Now, the trouble is you need to know the number of rotations in the ionosphere. So what we had to do was switch the frequency of the radar and try and observe the change in the polarization. From that, deduce how many total rotations there would be. And so it was my job as electronics expert to make the radar switch off tune. And that really proved very difficult. It was a very narrow band system with lots of frequency multipliers. It wasn't what you really would have liked would have been an up-down heterodyne system where you develop both in the receiver and in the transmitter, the required frequencies were local oscillators, and then you could shift one or more of these. Well, the receiver was, of course, a multiple superheterodyne, but the transmitter was mostly frequency multipliers.
I see.
This had two very bad effects. It meant you couldn't tune it very readily, because multipliers are very, very non-linear.
Right.
And also meant that the pulses were quite badly chirped, because your amplitude modulating the multiplier, and that's a bad thing to do. So there was a lot of gain lost in the system because of the way it was built.
How far did you want to shift in frequency?
We wanted to shift about, as much as we could, really. We would have liked 5 or 10%. We ended up shifting plus or minus about 1.5%. Fortunately, the effect goes as the square of the frequency. So this gave us something like a 5% effect.
So it seems to me then that your whole effort was designed not so much to study the moon, but the ionosphere. Is that correct?
Well, not entirely. We also wanted to properly identify the rapid fading mechanism, which we sort of surmised was due to the multiplicity of scattering centers on the moon.
What sort of scales now do you mean when you say rapid and slow in
well,
two cases?
In this particular radar, it used to send out a pulse roughly every second. And there'd be correlation times of a couple of seconds. In other words, there'd be some correlation between echo amplitudes, but very little. And then the slow fading would take periods over around half an hour or so.
I see.
To see a maximum go to a minimum. Well, anyway, based on the data then available, Ian Brown did an analysis of the rapid fading, and by studying essentially the autocorrelation function, tried to compare that with the fading pattern you would have expected for a moon that had scatterers, say, distributed all over it, and if you could see it, would appear uniformly bright, or a moon that was either was actually limbright, as if they had preferentially directed scatters on the limbs, and one that was bright in the middle. And he actually made a mistake in his calculations, a factor of 2 pi or something, it's easily done. And there was no good fit to the data. And we sort of, in that Murray Hargreaves Evans paper, published a rather inconclusive story on the rapid fading.
This one in 1956. Mm-hmm. But that by then you had 2 years' worth of lunar echoes, according to the abstract here.
No, not... All right. A year had been more or less Sandy Murray's work. And I'd spent a year rebuilding the radar. Turned out that it barely got echoes. So the first thing I did was to rebuild the transmitter to give 10 times as much power. And that took some time, so I had to do it all myself. And I wasn't very skilled. I mean, I had a lot of experience making television sets and things, but not in high power transmitters.
Mm-hmm.
And making the receiver more sensitive, building new front ends and so on. I sort of increased the sensitivity of the system by about a factor of 20, and then threw away a large fraction of that, a factor of 5 or so, perhaps, when I switched off tune. So that the antenna was fairly narrow band too, but we then had a workable system to give reliable results when we were switching off tune, which is what we couldn't do with the original system. And that took about a year. At the end of that year, I started to get some results on the effect of the switching. And so that paper contains the first results on the effects of the switching and Ian's analysis of Sandy Murray's rapid fading echoes, plus a few that we'd collected ourselves.
I see.
But reaching rather inconclusive sort of position on what the actual scattering mechanism was.
The nature of the lunar surface.
Yes.
Well, can you tell me how this effort related to the others at Java? I assume the meteor radar people, you were probably working closely with them, but are not true.
Totally independent. In fact, each of the groups is really... The meteor people had some common interests with several meteor groups, but the moon radar was really off, totally on the side. And, was just regarded as bloody nuisance because we had these horribly long pulses. We transmit 30 millisecond pulses once every second, and we just clobbered everybody else. So they just hated us.
I assume that you worked out when you were going to be transmitting versus when people were going to be doing at least critical observations.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Anyway, when I spent, having made these changes to radar, spent sort of about 18 months or so collecting echoes in the switching frequency mode. Unfortunately, the range of declinations we could cover was limited, and so you could only see the moon for 2 weeks out of every lunar month.
I see.
So you'd see the moon for 1 hour a day for 2 weeks of the month, and the hour a day shifted roughly by an hour a day. So what I was trying to do was connect records together to try and get the actual diurnal variation of the total electron content, and it was difficult.
You had long-term variations also in the ionosphere.
Well, there were day-to-day variations. It didn't repeat perfectly. So there are ambiguities that you never wholly resolve. Nevertheless, it showed that the technique did work, and you could, if you could follow the moon, get fairly good total content measurements, which in fact we did when the 250-foot dish was built some years later, finished some years later. Anyway, I also took a look at the rapid fading problem, discovered Ian Brown's problem of his 2 pi, wrote a paper which gave the correct result, namely that the Loom is very limb dark. It has a bright spot in the middle. It does most of the scattering.
Let's see, this would be Proceedings of Physical Society 57. Most reflection from the central 10% of the disk.
Yes, yes. That was the paper that set that right. Yeah. Ian sort of offered to commit halikari when he heard about it.
Let me also ask about this period of 54 to 57. What other groups were there working in lunar radar that
we knew about? None. Although it turned out that the Navy had a fairly active group under what's the guy's name? Into the team.
Not at the Naval Research Lab.
Yes.
You mean the fellow using it for communications primarily? Yeah.
Yes.
What's his name? I know who you mean.
He had built a 220-foot section of a parabola, which illuminated obliquely, and had done the brute force experiment of sending a very short pulse and measuring how much it was lengthened. That's what we would have liked to have done. We didn't have the sensitivity. We were obliged to measure from the fading pattern, yeah, the distribution of scattering centers and infer something about, you know, whether it was limb bright or not. In other words, if it were uniformly bright, then you have a wide spectrum because the Doppler broadening is from the full width of the moon.
Right.
And that would give you a more rapid fading than if you have just scattered from the middle and there's less Doppler broadening and slower fading. So we were really measuring the transform of the spectrum. And we had to go back from the spectrum to the distribution. Right.
Trexler,
yeah.
Well, but his work was all classified. You didn't know
his work was all classified. We didn't know about it. Lovell went off to this meeting at Jersey in 1957 in Boulder, taking with him two of my papers, one on the scattering characteristics of the moon, and the second on the total electron content. The second one he never gave, but when he arrived, by this time, the U.S. Air Force had been partially supporting our work, and the contact was Jules Aarons at AFCRL. And so Lovell probably told Aarons about this. And Aarons, who knew what was going on in the United States, went and told the Navy people and chortled that, you know, for the small 10 KSO, he'd been paying to Jodrell Bank.
Right.
He had the answer to the problem that he knew they were spending, you know, a million or so to get the answer on. And they were about to be presented at this meeting, whereupon the Navy people wired home and got permission to release some of their results.
I see. So Trexler was actually at that meeting?
I believe both Trexler and Yapley were, and gave papers releasing some of their information. So Lovell was able to come home and tell me that, you know, yeah, you're right. However, he went the first.
How does one get U.S. Air Force money in England?
In those days, AFOSR, the Air Force Office of Sponsored Research, had an office in Brussels and supported a lot of research throughout the European community. And what had actually happened was that one of our guys, Jerry Hawkins, had come over to the States to work at Smithsonian on meteors, and somehow had come in contact with Jules Aarons, and Jules Aarons had sort of made him his agent and told him that the next time he was back at Jodrell to scout around, see if there was any good work going on that deserved to be supported. And Hawkins duly came back and persuaded Lovell to accept some money. Lovell was very suspicious, especially in his dealings with Americans. He was rather anti-American. And anyway, Hawkins got around him. I put some pressure on because we could really use the money. We had no money to buy instruments and things.
Yeah. So it wasn't a matter of you guys looking around for money, but it sort of came to you.
It actually came to us. And it was, you know, it was like $10,000 or something. It was a useful amount to buy a scope or something.
But then there was also a lot of NASA money that came into Java later on. So Lovell must have gotten over this.
Yes, well, he was essentially forced to. The whole business of costs of the telescope put him in a very awkward position.